So good morning. Good morning, everyone. My name is Candace. I'm one of the local Dharma leaders, and I'll be leading the sit and giving the talk this morning. Our topic is tranquility, which is something I think we can all appreciate at the moment, how tricky it can be to get there. As most of you are aware, this year at Seattle Insight, we're exploring Transcendental Dependent Arising from the Upanishad Sutta, a path we can choose from suffering to liberation. We've moved from suffering to faith, to joy, to rapture, and have now reached tranquility, pasadi. That word, tranquility, for me, it conjures a memory of sitting on a bluff above Rosario Beach. The only sounds, the wind and seagulls, the susurration of waves down below, the bees. I'm completely relaxed, warmed by the sun. The world around me is peaceful. Nothing can harm me. Or it conjures my image when I started meditation of a meditator in lotus position, still, calm, impervious to the world. It was how I hoped meditation would change me instantly. Or a pond that's utterly still, no ripples, nothing. But such a pond, if it's always calm, still unmoved, unchanged, becomes stagnant, gathering scum. It needs aeration. Pasadi, the fifth step in Transcendental Dependent Arising, is vibrant, dynamic, holding more complexity and energy than we might guess. And I hope I get that across this morning. I've really been intrigued by this. Before I go on, I want to say that I approach Transcendental Dependent Arising not as a roadmap to or of exalted states, but as cycles that we can experience throughout our days, both on and off the cushion, much like awakening, moment to moment. The Upanishad Sutta is a brief teaching the Buddha gave in which he explains the destruction of the cankers, sensual craving, craving for experience, I am, false views, and ignorance. He explains this by beginning at the point of liberation, the knowledge of the destruction of the cankers. And then he explores the immediate supporting conditions of each step going down, down, down to suffering. It's a curious choice of organization, I thought when I first read it. From liberation to suffering, and then to the dependent origination list in which we spin in suffering. And then he follows the path in reverse. A description of the flow. So it's a description of the flow of our experience with first an inspiration, inspiring us with what we can achieve and contrasting that to the wheel of suffering. We see this beautiful calmness and then we see the wheel of suffering, but there's the choice of arising in this calmness. And just as with all of our explorations last year with the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, how we acknowledge dukkha and our part in it, here is a description of how we free ourselves from suffering, step by step, moment by moment. Buddha said he taught one thing, suffering and the end of suffering, and here he summarized how he saw the movement, the flow of the path. He's so helpful. He gives us the map. This is how it will happen. For me, exploring how to free myself from suffering, not dukkha, but the suffering that arises when I fight with what is, how to free myself moment to moment, step by step, is far more helpful than wondering how to achieve exalted states. Because frankly, that for me leads to more suffering because greed arises. I want that. But the possibility of moments of liberation in my daily life, wow, that's inspiring. That engages me. I had such a moment in meditation this past week. Looking back, I see that I've been agitated for days. Something to do with work, changes that I did not like, and the general state of the world. And I think many of you can appreciate that. And that morning, as I gathered myself into stillness, settled, focusing on the out-breath as a release of unskillful energy, I felt the anger teasing at the edge of my mind. And I thought, I no longer want to expend my energy on being angry. I just don't want to carry this anger anymore. I explored that idea for a moment, noticing it, labeling it, feeling it. And I thought, yes, I can choose this. I felt a surge of energy with that. Like, oh, yeah, now how am I going to do this? And then I felt a calm. And within that calm, I saw myself just saying no to the anger. And how that opened up possibilities, space. Wow. I tasted tranquility. I felt what it might be like to calmly abide, to be spacious in my response to life, to observe what's happening without being blown off the path. I'll come back to that. I just wanted to make clear that I'm not talking about exalted states achieved through long retreats, but the tranquility that's possible in our daily lives. Pasadi, tranquility. It's also translated as calm, serenity, composure, calm abiding. It arises out of rapture or a keen interest in and commitment to the path that's developed out of our choice to choose the path of the Dharma to end our suffering, and the joy that arises when we feel the effects of not getting caught up in our old unskillful habits. After the energy of rapture, which can be pretty intense at times, tranquility is a cooling, calming, soothing state. Joseph Goldstein says, it's the quality of calm that keeps the mind composed and unruffled in times of difficulty. He says he hasn't taught tranquility much, partly because it's just not as sexy as concentration or rapture, but that it's essential for concentration and awakening. Both Joseph and Bhikkhu Bodhi point out the dynamic qualities of this tranquility. To quote Bhikkhu Bodhi, tranquility further induces in both consciousness and its adjuncts the qualitative factors of lightness, malleability, wieldiness, proficiency, and rectitude. These factors, present to some extent in every wholesome state of consciousness, perform the respective tasks of eliminating sluggishness, so this isn't that stagnant pawn, rigidity, unwieldiness, disability, I can't do it, I can't do it, and insincerity. I'm fascinated by that last one, that we become more open and natural and honest when we're at ease in ourselves. All this indicates a vibrancy, a tranquility is a state of alertness, collected focus, open-minded, open-hearted, energy to act, and sincerity. It's not quiet, but it's still. I've mentioned before a character in a long-running series of mysteries that I've been writing for a long time, Magda Digby, the River Woman, a skilled healer. On the surface, she's a tiny, elderly woman, wizened, her face a map of wrinkles, but she's strong. This is the 14th century. She walks miles through woods or around the city to visit patients, sits by their bedsides through the night, gathers moss, roots, bark, and herbs in the forest, lives by herself. Her skill has been honed over years of experience and keen attention, but there's also something about her very presence that comforts those in distress. She judges no one as unworthy of her attention. Not that she's gullible. She sees through their posturing and dissimulation and isn't above chuckling when they're being fools. But she sees no need to defend herself from them with anger or cruelty. For her, it's enough that she sees. When she holds someone's hands and looks into their eyes, they feel warm, held, and that she knows all that is in their minds. No matter the chaos around her, she maintains this inner calm. It's not dependent on everything in her life being just so. Her life is never like that. This is the 14th century, no modern medicine, and she cannot always save her patients. She witnesses their suffering, and she cares. She's also distrusted by those who have never come close to her, never had the sense to trust her because she's different. In the 14th century, a woman living alone, not attending church, speaking to authorities as an equal, that was all very dangerous. But the people who need her come to her regardless, because they know she will care for them without judging. And she clearly loves life. Her laughter is a bark, and her eyes often tease with affection. Yet she knows and has known suffering in her own life, loss of family members. And she witnesses suffering all around her all the time. A healer does. Even so, she's not shaken. Her strength comes from within. It's not dependent on everything being calm and supportive around her. She quietly goes about living a life of service to the community and refers to herself in the third person as a reminder that her patients are the focus, not her. Arrogance has no place in her work. This, to me, is a portrait of tranquility. Calm abiding that arises from a commitment to an intention to heal, to respect all life. As I've worked with Magda, I've come to admire her, take her as my guide, which is an odd thing when you think about it, because I've created her. I am creating her. One of my teachers said that I'm teaching myself the Dharma through her. And it's true that working with her, thinking about her, is a refuge and an inspiration for me. When Joseph describes the state of tranquility as bringing with it the wholesome states of lightness, open-minded, open-hearted, with a sense of humor and an ease of selfing, wieldiness or flexibility, proficiency and sincerity, I see Magda Digby, and in writing her, being in her head, I feel the beauty of it, and I believe that I can live that way. There's that faith at the beginning of this arising. Calm abiding is possible. Tranquility arises from our practice on and off cushion. It's progression. It doesn't suddenly occur like I had hoped when I began meditation. But there's nothing wrong with encouraging tranquility. And what a gift that is to ourselves and everyone around us in this moment. Bhante Anuttara says, Pasadi holds pragmatic applicability in our daily lives. In our modern society characterized by agitation, Pasadi offers the relevant antidote. The seed of calm and tranquility lies within us and can be cultivated through systematic practice. He suggests mindfulness of breathing, as outlined in the Anapanasati Sutta, and there's going to be a class on that soon, but at least to be ever mindful of your breath. And we can do this throughout our day, noticing when we're feeling a feeling, how is my breath? Am I panting? Am I holding my breath? Is it jagged? That tells you a lot about your mind in the moment. Deep, slow, rhythmic breathing calms our nervous system. He also suggested walking meditation, or really any type of exercise that's done with mindfulness. Qigong, Tai Chi, yoga. I need to take my blood pressure several times a week, first thing in the morning. I have white coat syndrome in the doctor's offices. My BP is always high when they take it. I warn them and they still go, oh. But at home, I had not had that problem until I needed to take it every day for a few weeks because something was going on. I developed white coat syndrome at home. I dreaded the cuff, and it was first thing in the morning, so it was like, oh, starting your day dreading something. And my blood pressure reflected that. How to resolve this? Through trial and error, I learned that my imagination could be my bane, my fear of the cuff giving me higher readings, or it could be my friend. Breathing exercises helped, but not enough. But imagining I was Magda Digby in the forest gathering herbs and roots, I have a lot of practice doing that. Being in her body, in her home, calmly seeing to a patient, or conjuring up the relaxation I feel when my cat falls asleep on my chest, purring, going limp, her body heat soothing my body. These images of tranquility work for me. I compose myself, collect my thoughts, embody the images. And I carry the tranquility into my day. So it becomes a practice that I actually look forward to. Joseph said that tranquility is essential for concentration and awakening. And what's beautiful about following the steps in Transcendental Dependent Arising is that we can see how our practice, how we're moving through the world, our mindfulness, our ability to be still, to pause, all leads to concentration and awakening. Each step on the path might seem like a small thing, but each is carrying us forward. And once we see the difference between the dukkha that will always walk with us in the world, things are not always as we just want them. And we recognize that the suffering we're piling atop that, we recognize that. We might just turn toward the Dharma with faith that we can liberate ourselves from the suffering. And when we see the signs that we're softening, lightening, we experience joy and get more committed. Bring more energy to our practice, and we arrive in calm abiding, a tranquility that arises from within. It's not dependent on our surroundings. Reaching this strong seat, it's possible to compose ourselves and concentrate, and even have a moment of awakening, and we'll still be alert enough to notice and rejoice. Let me return to that moment when I understood that I could set aside my anger and that doing so would allow more space. It's not something I'd been thinking about before I sat, but in stillness, the thought arose. It surprised me. I'm often surprised by what comes up in meditation. But they had the space to arise and be noticed. Not just the monkey mind trying to keep up the patter, but insights. My best ideas for scenes arise in meditation, when I'm trying to set aside my work. And it happens because I'm still. I'm allowing space. And suddenly something that has eluded me arises in that peace. In this instance, it was an awareness that I was tired of anger, exhausted, and I could see the space that choosing to let the world be, just see it for what it is, that's all. Just see and let it be, what space that would open for me to make good decisions. I could see it, feel it. The relaxation response was strong, visceral. I could imagine myself calmly abiding in the world without letting the worldly winds push me off my calm, off my path. I was tranquil for a moment. Since then, I've reminded myself many times how that felt, how Magda-like that decision is. And I am amazed by how easily and gently I can acknowledge the anger, allow it, I'm not ignoring it, and let it pass on. I'm not sticking on it. In that moment of calm abiding, the skillful response arises in me. And it's so helpful. To finish, I want to read the poem that popped up in my inbox a few days ago that feels like a wonderful, silly example of calm abiding. And it also was a great example of a day of work that would have been in the past very frustrating. Writing a scene one way, writing a scene another way, trashing them both, and just feeling like, well, this was a wasted day. But I knew I'm getting somewhere. And that's new for me. So this poem tickled me. The Jam by Peter Piak. Mary wants to make some jam, so she buys 1,000 mason jars, 700 quart size, 200 pint size, and, for variety, 100 half pint. She likes making jam. Next, she goes to the fruit stand and buys an orchard of peaches, but at £4 to the dollar, she feels, it's a steal. The fruit stand delivers the peaches in a truck. It dumps them into the kitchen. The kitchen is getting a little cramped with a ton of peaches and all those mason jars. We phone all the people we know to borrow canning pots. We rent a U-Haul, 16-footer, to pick them up. We get our sugar directly from Cuba. It costs a little more, and the diplomatic procedures are horrendous, but Mary feels it's sweeter. For the next 72 hours, we peel, dice, and boil peaches, sterilize the jars, and add gallons of pectin, which we bought from a wholesaler at a bargain. After all the jars are filled, we realize we forgot to buy the lids. We call all over and find that there are none to be had. As the jam begins to spoil, I grow desperate, but not Mary. She feels it was all worth it. She says, I like making jam. That's tranquility. May we all find tranquility in the midst of it all. Even 1,000 jars of spoiling jam. Can we sit for a moment and let the words sink in? Reflect on what interested you this morning, what you're thinking about tranquility or calm abiding. Thank you for your kind attention. How are you all feeling about tranquility or your practice or life in general? You can raise your hand. A few people have had to leave. Or you can wave at me, I think I can see everybody, and share your thoughts. We can all benefit from them. Thomas.
Thanks a lot, Candace, for your very inspiring talk. And what comes to mind around tranquility, when I look at my own sort of journey inside meditation, I think originally it was a want. I wanted to be more calm, less stressed, those kinds of qualities. And so I went in with that expectation, and it delivered. I would say sitting down meditating every day certainly gave some relief in those areas. But it's where I'm at now is looking at tranquility more as a byproduct, really, something that is a product of the practice of doing these things on a regular basis. And it's becoming less of a want as I'm realizing that it's sort of better to just sit with the mind states I have, whether I like them or not, you know, just spend time with them, don't try to make them go away, but try to understand what's going on. And then more tranquility comes out of that. And so it's really, as I look at those three components we've been looking at, rapture, joy, etc., it is when you really commit to the practice, these things start to occur. And one thing I found is sort of really surprising is I'm less drawn to where all the action and all the noise is, because I'm seeking more of the tranquility. It makes me more happy. So yeah, sort of my choices are starting to get a little influenced. I'm, you know, less noisy activity stuff, but more sort of being with simple things like going for a hike or, you know, having a good conversation with a neighbor or whatever it is. Simple stuff like that makes me more happy than it did. So just a few reflections. So thanks again for a great, great talk.
Thank you, Thomas. That really is, you know, that's where we see how it's affecting other people. And it's wonderful to share that, isn't it? Just what's working for us. Sounds like it's really working for you to sit with those feelings. That it has its benefit. It's not just sitting with the feelings. There's something comes out of it. Some peace comes out of that. Judith.
Hi. Thanks, Candace. It was lovely talk. One thing you got me thinking about was the role of creativity in creating, in letting in joy and tranquility and all of these good mind states. And like you, of course, I have done a lot of writing. And I've often thought about the periods in my life when I was writing and when I wasn't writing. And I've written lots of different things, poetry, songs, haiku lately. And it seems like the times when I was being creative in some ways, these were better times than when I wasn't. And that it's like opening a door. You know, like when I find I haven't written a haiku for a few days or something like that, it's like, oh, and I'll open the haiku door. And there's this, it's like letting in a part of yourself, you know, that you're not always in touch with. Obviously, Magda is part of you, right?
Oh, yeah.
Even though she's telling you things you don't even know you know. But there she is, right? And it's the same thing with me writing a haiku. It's, oh yes, okay. On some level, I'm seeing that, but I'm not necessarily aware of it until I open that door. And there are so many ways to be creative, obviously, not just the arts, you know. But I really have recognized how important it is for just overall happiness, contentment, and tranquility, right?
Oh, thank you for that, Judith. Yeah, it's remarkable what we learn about what we're thinking when we write or we give a talk or we sing or we dance. I have a friend who's a dancer, and And she's very good at expressing, I mean, her movements are expressing what's going on. And she says sometimes she realizes, I didn't know that was bothering me. Mm-hmm. And gardening, mm-hmm. and how we feel about the, it's some kind of, it's opening to the wisdom within us that we just sometimes are so shut down because we're busy with dealing with the external world from a persona or something. So, yeah, it's a real gift. Yeah. We can all do it.
Exactly.
When we tell stories to the kids and make these things up, I mean, I've been amazed at watching some adults who don't seem terribly creative. And the stories, they're just conjuring for the kids. And you just go, yeah, we all have it. We just don't always use it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Faith.
I have a statement question combo, because for years I worked with myself and with students and clients using something called interactive guided imagery, which is a way to contact an inner space that felt supportive and lovely to be in, but also the presence of guidance one way or another. And sometimes the actual imagery of a healer, like you describe, that can be their guide, help them with the situation. My question, and I'm thinking, gosh, that was really great, and I still do it with people. I never thought of combining them in any way with meditation. And I'm wondering, sometimes I feel the presence of my guide, and I'm thinking, is that an intrusion, or is that something that I can incorporate?
I guess explore it, because it's coming from within. Mm-hmm. So I did a lot of shamanic journeying at one time.
Yes.
And and you call up your guide. So it was a very deep meditation in many ways. Mm-hmm. But yeah, explore whether you're making an effort to conjure it up, or whether it's just arising. It's just arising. Because sometimes I'll have, because I live with all these characters, I'll have a character arise in my meditation with an emotion or a response to something, and I realize that my body is responding with a relaxation or a tenderness or softness. And I don't reject that. If I start planning a scene, that I say later. But if it's just this something that it's bringing up for me, we're story creatures. So it could just be, this is how your inner wisdom is arising for you in the moment. I play with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. And also the difference between conjuring and allowing something to arise is something that might be worth exploring in this, because I do want things to happen in my body and all kinds of places.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm trying to control the whole deal. So just thinking, okay, did this just pop up, or am I making this happen? Or yeah, thank you.
Yeah, great question. And that sounds like a wonderful way of encouraging people into opening up to their inner wisdom and feeling safe. Sarah.
I'm struggling to find the hand. But I'm somewhat new to the practice, especially in the Dharma talks, and I will just to be vulnerable to say one of the reasons I'm here is that I've been dealing with a lot of agitation and anxiety in my life, and I had no idea the topic was going to be calm and tranquil. But one of the things you said, and I think it's been reflected in some other people said, was that imagination, you know, can be your bane, but it perhaps, you know, can be cultivated to be your friend. And that along with breathing, I think is going to help me personally from today. And also, I just want to thank Thomas, because being new to this, sitting in agitation, especially when it's reflecting on calm and tranquility, it feels very far away. But the idea that through the practice, like, don't, I shouldn't just say, uh-oh, not me, but through this practice, kind of a question, even if I'm feeling this really deep anxiety that's hard, that there is a possibility of sitting with that and reaching more states of tranquility. Yes, and it's a little bit of a question. And also, just like little, how to find the little pieces of calm in the midst of it all, I guess, right?
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things that has really helped me, and thanks for being so candid, Sarah. One of the things that's really helped me is doing metta for myself in moments when, what's coming up is so intense. And I just, Philip Moffat at one retreat one year just kept patting his chest and saying, meta, 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 and just kind of rubbing, you know, meta, 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 meta. And it just viscerally, I mean, relaxed me. And many of us started crying, because to be so kind to ourselves is something new. It's bringing up in us this possibility of being our own refuge. It's just a wonderful, it's a wonderful difference from a lot of our culture, which is very sometimes aggressive, critical, to just be sweet to ourselves, or to imagine someone else, which is part of the meta phrases, someone else who we respect, who has helped us in the past, who we love, giving us meta, to imagine that, you know, it can even be your cat, I mean, but you know, it's legitimate to imagine the Dalai Lama standing in front of you and saying, be good to yourself, you deserve it. I mean, and then you can sit with the anxiety without it being a panic attack.
Right. Thank you so much for that. That's helpful.
You're welcome. Anyone else? Julie.
Hi. Thanks, Candace. That was really lovely. I made a comment, I think it was last week, about one of the most effective ways that I feel a lot of joy and rapture throughout the course of the day is, you know, just keep continually revisiting this insight that I'm just trying to really ingrain in my way of thinking and being with the world, just, you know, the interconnectedness of everything. But I did, you know, I'm coming back to that a lot with your question with the tranquility. And I think part of the reason is because, you know, I mean, I found that with practice, it, this whole not self idea where, you know, you don't feel, you start to feel, or I start to feel less and less, what's the word? Like, in less and less ownership of these feelings of criticism and negativity and that, and this sort of way of looking at the world, which, you know, is basically how I was raised and how I've lived most of my life, is let's always see a glass half empty and let's always find what's wrong. And so this practice is very much a training to separate from that, because when I'm not so identified with it, I don't feel ownership of it. And then I'm going to take that Philip Moffat thing with me too. You know, meta, meta, meta. I love that. But that's just my little share for the way that most reliably brings tranquility to me. And I don't claim that it's always available to me, but the more I practice it, the more it is. And that's just to be able to look at myself through that, awareness of me that doesn't, you know, it just sort of separates everything and makes everything feel kind of surrounded in loving acceptance. Mm. So that's my offering.
That's so beautiful, Julie. Thank you so much. And it is so, it's so beautiful to feel the connection that it isn't all down to us, that we're a part of something. That as Rodney Smith used to always say, you are an integral part of the world. Never question that. Wherever you are right now, it's where you need to be. And it's just such a beautiful feeling. It's why we love going out in nature, because we can feel the connection. Thank you so much for reminding us of that. Neil.
Yeah, thanks for the talk, Candace. I think it's related to what you were talking about with calm abiding. I think similarly to Thomas, of just being with, you know, what's present. And I think for me, what I've been, what kind of comes up is just having faith in myself and knowing that it's something, I think it's something, it reminds me of something that Tuari mentioned, I remember in a talk about, regardless of what I'm going through, I've probably gone through something similar to it before and I've gotten through it and I'm going to get through it again, because there's no, you don't get a choice of like, do you go get through it or do you not get through it? You just get through it because that's the only thing that you can do. And so I think like, just having faith in myself that regardless of whether the situation, whatever I'm feeling, I can just be with that. I think that feels like, you know, one aspect of what comes up to me with tranquility. I think the other aspect is having the awareness of what do I need to be doing in this moment? And that can sometimes be really hard to figure that out at times. And then knowing that, having the faith that regardless of what I do, I can be with it and I can continue to learn and I can try to figure out what do I need to do in this moment, but not worrying about all these other things of what should I do? You know, what is the right thing to do in this moment? Not even sometimes not having awareness of what I need to be doing and that leading to, you know, causing my suffering. I think being able to bring that awareness to the moment and knowing what I need to do is helpful. And then also just being able to fall back on having the faith that regardless of what I do, I can be with it. And I think that kind of like relates to me a little bit. It's like you seem to be talking about something that calm abiding.
That's really beautiful. That's really beautiful. Do you have a practice, a technique for when you're trying to think of what needs to be done in this moment? Is it pausing and just kind of feeling it, or?
I mean, I think that's part of what I've been, I think this has been a timely topic for me, because I think there has been a lot of lack of tranquility these last couple of weeks. And I think for me, like one of the hardest places to bring awareness has always been work and having that awareness of what's present during the day, because it feels like it's so easy to spiral into just work and stress about what needs to be done. And I think there's all these avenues with work that selfing can arise and like you kind of get caught up in the worldly winds. And it's a difficult avenue of practice for me. And so I think part of it has been just trying to do my best to bring that intention during the day and like kind of like having the awareness that I'm probably going to start with that intention and then it's going to fade as the workday progresses. I think one thing I've sometimes done, I was doing last week, was intentionally moving slowly. And so with every movement I'm taking, like whether it's typing, whether it's walking, whatever it's doing, intentionally doing that movement slowly, and that kind of, I feel like that it just helps take me out of the rushing and give me that space to sometimes have that awareness of what do I need to be doing in the moment. But even that, it tends to fade a little bit, you know, as the work progresses. But I think like if that's where the faith of like knowing whatever happens, I can be with it, and you know, it just slowly, slowly builds.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Slowing down is, you know, we talk a lot about the pause, but just slowing down can be a really, really great technique. And we can feel how that energy to push us is always there behind us. I used to think it was my mother, but I think I've let her go. You know, I said, no, it's not you, Mom. It's the world. It's me. It's, you know, but
Oh, it can be really hard sometimes. Like, especially when I first start doing it, there's so much, it doesn't feel right. It feels unnatural. It feels like you start noticing how much just like conditioning there is to move quickly and with everything you're sometimes doing in your routine. And then after doing it for a little while, I notice myself sometimes settling into it. So yeah, it's been a helpful practice.
Mm. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for sharing what you have. Anyone else before we let go? Lauren, I have a feeling that you've wanted to talk and haven't had your hand up. Is that true, or am I just... Oh, you're muted.
Actually, I did have my little hand out to maybe press it. And I guess what I'm thinking is the part of the body, of the connection of the mind and body, a friendship, you know, that they're one and unified. And I've been doing Qigong for about almost 20 years now, and it just has helped me so much. And one of the things that I notice is that I hold my stomach. And one of the things we've been working on in Qigong was release. And I just say that to myself many times a day. I check my stomach and I have to release it. And that release is so important, and it brings me to the moment. So it's really like release here and now. So it's a combination of the tension in my body, release it, and be here and now, and release in here and now. And that really has been a grounding for tranquility for me. So thank you being so intuitive there, Magda.
That's beautiful, Lauren. I do that too. I can feel my body just clenching sometimes, not just my stomach, my jaws.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a big jaw clencher. Yeah.
I have that issue.
My dentist has told me to sing in the car because I can't clench my teeth about the traffic if I'm singing. So I sing a lot when I drive now. Lyndall.
Yeah, I thank you for talking about Magda. I love that character too. I'm just thinking about what Lauren said about here and now, and I think one of the things that really helps me to experience tranquility is to actually appreciating the here and now. You know, actually, it's so easy for me to rush off into the future and start worrying about what's going to happen and can I get this done. And so if I remember to come back to the present and be in the present and appreciate the present, and have that sense of, I don't need anything different. That's such a basis for tranquility. And it's not always there, but in those moments, it really is there. When I feel like, yeah, this is okay. This is enough.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Yeah. Yeah. we often talk about being in the moment, but we don't talk about why. What that's doing, the magic of it.
It is magic of it. It is. It is magic.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I think we're coming to the end of our time. And I wanted to just take a moment now to gather all this wonderful loving energy that we've gathered here today and dedicate the merit of this practice for all beings who are facing danger, who are in fear, who are hiding, friends who might be waiting for diagnoses or suffering, recovering. All of this merit goes to all who are suffering in any way, including our planet. And may all beings be heard and respected and seen. May they find community and places of refuge. And may they be happy. Thank you all. This has been a real joyous morning. I've really enjoyed it.